Tonight, an evening with Richard C. Hoagland from TheEnterpriseMission.com, author of the best-selling Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, soon to be in its updated edition as well, because there's more information coming all the time. I suspect that tonight's interview and chat with Richard C. Hoagland may go down as one of those classic nights, because in a moment, he's about ready to release a story that just might knock your socks off. So stand by. Okay, I could say he's a former Space Science Museum curator. I could say he's a former NASA consultant during the historic Apollo missions to the moon. I could say he was science advisor to Walter Cronkite in CBS News. I could also say that he continues to investigate some incredible stories, critically acclaimed independent analysis of possible intelligently designed artifacts, let's say on Mars, maybe the moon. I could say all those things, but I think I'd just rather introduce our friend and science advisor, head of TheEnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, for a full show. Richard, how are you?
Hi there, George. That was a very clever introduction.
Unwritten, ad-lib totally.
Well, how long have we known each other?
A long time.
Two or three lifetimes?
A long time, my friend. How's everybody? How's Robin? And by the way, thank Robin for the introduction to Kevin Miller, who's now been on the show sporadically twice, but he's just an expert on these pharmaceutical drugs.
And I am looking forward to a show where they do it together with you.
We are planning something bigger than you can imagine.
Well, you know, this whole vaccination thing, which we're moving inexorably toward, I just listened to your first hour while I was prepping the post that I've got up on Enterprise Now, and it's really scary. If these trend curves continue, you know, there is pretty serious stuff up ahead. But fortunately, we have Coast, and we have this audience, and we have a mobilized electorate, and that's why I think it would be useful to consider her in the picture when you want to talk about vaccinations.
Absolutely. And we have you, Richard. And, you know, I think back at just all the wonderful programs that you have brought to this audience, from the Art Bell era to what I'm doing now, and you just keep thundering along for us, and I appreciate that.
Well, you know, we have some friends out there. In fact, we have a lot of friends. Technically, they're on Facebook. But we're getting a lot of leaks now, really interesting leaks on an extending curve that tell me that we're going to come to some interesting new breakpoints, nodal points. Points where stuff actually, you know, meets the road. And so what I want to do tonight is I want to use the next 3 hours to expand this audience's imagination and perception and projectability of the future. I want to really go outside the box. I want to speculate. I want to lay some foundation, some amazing facts which have just come to us, to Enterprise. And then I want to spend a lot of the program in terms of scenario playing. You know how the agencies, so-called alphabet agencies, work. They get a bunch of experts in a room, or these days they do it by email, and they basically speculate. They take the known database, and then they ask people deliberately to think of the most far-out scenario that they can conceive could happen. And then they run the permutations to see what the effects would be on the real world if those events came to pass. Well, we kind of do that here at Coast. You know, every night you do this in various disciplines. But I don't know whether a lot of people realize that what we're going to talk about tonight, just as much as monetary policy or health, you know, for enforced vaccinations for flu epidemics that are not real, that are chimerical, is as important to consider in terms of the areas that I cover, which is, you know, space and the impact of celestial mechanics and you know, the fiscal expenditures of the NASA budget and all that, as all these other areas, because those are the big picture items, the things that I'm talking about, that impact you in ways that you don't see, that are surreptitious, that are, if they're there, they make your life better. If they're not there, if we make policy decisions where they are deliberately withheld from, you know, the American people, then our life is going to be a lot poorer.
Absolutely. And it's, to me, Richard, It all seems to be around control, manipulation.
It's all about
broader
control.
Picture.
It is totally about control.
It truly
and,
is.
And tonight I'm going to raise the specter that it's about control of 6 billion people who, in the eyes of some people, have a drop-dead date, that they are perceived as superfluous beyond a certain point. And I will explain in some detail what I mean by that later in the evening.
Have your views changed over the years since you were working as a NASA consultant, working on the moon projects with Cronkite and CBS News? I got to believe that the Richard Hoagland of that era was, you know, accepting the towing the company line, grabbing the stories as they came, but you believed in things. You believed in the presentation of government. And I think as you've aged, or should I say matured.
It sounds like I'm wine.
Yeah.
I'm fine wine.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
That I think you've changed dramatically. I didn't know the Richard C. Hoagland from years ago, but I guess I've seen a metamorphosis with you just in 6 or 7 years.
Oh, that's interesting. And which direction do you think it's gone?
I think you have gone more in depth of not believing what's going on. Maybe it was Monuments of Mars that started things for you. I'm not sure. But I have seen you go from just a very open person to someone who is very suspicious now of organizations and groups. And I think that's healthy, but I've seen it in a dramatic way with you. Am I right?
Well, yeah, basically you're right. I mean, remember what Ben Franklin said to that woman outside Independence Hall in Philadelphia when they had signed drafted and enacted the Constitution, ratified it?
I know it wasn't "Don't pull in the kite." It wasn't that one.
No. She said, "Mr. Franklin, what kind of a government do we have?" And, you know, we don't know whether this is apocryphal or, in fact, it's an actual quote. But regardless, it's one heck of a statement. He says, "Madam, a republic, if we can keep it."
And if we can keep it.
And the price of this republic, it's not a democracy. It's a republic for a really good reason. Because ordinary people in their day-to-day lives do not have time to monitor all the skullduggery that's going on.
Wasn't it also Ben Franklin who said, "We must all hang together,
or we will hang.
We will all hang separately."
Yep. He was very good at that. he was a wordsmith. But, when I was young, when I was 23, I was talking to someone the other day, and I was 23 when I, went with Cronkite. I mean, I knew nothing. I was this starry-eyed kid. You know, I grew up on the American dream, on everything that we're taught, you know, about the founding fathers and the country and where we're going and political figures and the fact that we were the last best hope of mankind. I think that's from Lincoln. And I still believe that. I still believe that this experiment in democracy, in Republican democracy, is the best thing going on the planet. The problem has been, as they say in the intelligence community, a captured program for too long. The country we now look at is not the country we should have. And it's not the country that I want to live in, or I want to, you know, swing its weight around on this planet. We need to get back closer to what the founders had in mind, but that requires a plugged-in electorate. That requires people who actually pay attention. And you can't pay attention to every detail. But you have to, as my grandmother used to say, if you don't know your furs, know your furrier. You can tell how old she was.
That is, because nobody buys furs anymore.
Well, it was pre-PETA, yes. But the point is that you have to put your trust in people who are worthy of your trust. And if your elected representatives are not doing what you want them to do, in this day and age where we are inundated with information 24/7, I mean, if I see one more frame of Michael Jackson's tribute, I am going to do something that I will not be held accountable for, because at the same time that that's going on in Los Angeles, the President of the United States is meeting with the President of the former Soviet Union, Russia, Medvedev.
Yep. Huge and story.
And the power behind the throne, Vladimir Putin. And the only place I could get in the last 24 hours a decent slice of what was going on the other side of the world in that critical set of meetings, you're not going to believe this, George, it was Fox. Everybody else was doing nothing but 24/7 Jackson.
I did not even mention the story today, the Jackson story. You know, we covered his death and we did those angles because it was a news story. But I said today, enough is enough. I think people want to just move on. And I think Elizabeth Taylor did it the best when she said, I'm not going there because I'm going to share my grief privately.
Yeah.
And that was probably the most telltaling.
Well,
I
don't want people to get the impression that I don't think Michael Jackson is worthy of some kind of tribute.
No, I know that.
Because I do, for a whole variety of reasons. I just think that what you're seeing, if you're an observer of media, like I have been ever since I worked with Cronkite, you are seeing the power of one story to blot out every other legitimate story that we should also be paying attention to in what's called parochially the news cycle. And if it's not Jackson, it's Palin. I mean, it's like we don't seem to be able in this society anymore to walk and chew gum at the same time, to borrow an ancient phrase. And we have to. We have got to be able to multitask. We have got to be able to do more than one thing at the same time. And I put this directly at the doorstep of the ratings greed, the fact that, you know, we have anchors sitting on television discussing with various other anchors the fact that if they try to deviate from the Jackson path in the last 12 days, their ratings plummeted. And, of course, the money guys say, well, you can't do that. You got to keep the ratings up. So we're basically in a money-driven, ratings-driven mania where we fixate on one thing and everything else goes by the board, and it's the everything else that's going to wind up, you know, doing us in unless we are paying really good attention, which, of course, is where the Internet comes in, because it used to be, back in the days when I was with Walter, that we had three networks, right? If those three networks got co-opted by some major, let's say, social story as opposed to a nitty-gritty meat and potatoes, this is going to affect the fate of the American people story, you were really up a creek. But I cannot remember in those days, except for a few occasions, obviously the assassination of Kennedy was one such occasion. But that, of course, affected us all. That was not a celebrity story. That was not a social story. That was not an entertainment story. That had absolutely bare roots that affected the next 30, 40, 50 years from the time that he was killed. Now, fortunately, we have something called the Internet, and we've got Coast. Those two areas seem to be the only bastion where if you want an alternative perspective, if you want to dig beneath the surface, you know, as Cooper says on 360, you know, digging deeper, you got to do it yourself. And you and Art have done an extraordinary job with this audience in training this audience, and that means anybody who tunes in and wants to listen and pay attention, that you've got to dig beneath the surface of the story, and there are stories that are critically important to your future that you will never see on CNN or MSNBC or Fox for maybe 5 or 10 years. Eventually, stories that are on Coast appear in the so-called mainstream. But those who listen to this show regularly know that we break things first and we dig deep and we bring you perspectives that you ever, never, ever hear until much later in the so-called mainstream network TV.
Next week is the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11. My 40 years already.
God, you know, that means I'm that much older. Ah.
You were giving tubes to Marconi when he was putting them in our ear. You were small, I'll grant you that,
it
but you were still
Tesla,
giving him
right?
tubes.
It was not Marconi, it was Tesla. But why should we quibble?
40
Yeah, what
years
I want to do tonight is I want to open people's ideas and imagination and perspectives to some things that are going on. They're not aware they're going on because, you know, what's happened in the last 12 days has crowded out all real news. And then project into the future what will happen if we don't stand by and just allow these events to take place.
Okay.
And I think this is the perfect audience to try this little experiment tonight with.
And you have been working very, very diligently on what we call, well, I'm going to let you break it. I'm not going to say it. I want you to say it. You're the one who's been working on it. But I've got to tell you, I've been to conferences. People still keep talking about the data head that you showed us and the robot head. And I have a feeling you've got a few more tricks up your sleeve here, don't you?
Well, there is a sea change going on. My beat, as you know, is NASA and space and the synoptic impact that it's going to have on 6 billion plus human beings as we move through the next several years. You're right. At the conference in California, I showed you this amazing image that came from the Apollo missions, from Apollo 17.
Yep.
What looks to be an android, a robotic head, lying in a crater on the moon at the Apollo 17 landing site. And it stood the test of time. Nobody has been able to knock down the idea that that's what it really is. But, of course, the implications of that are staggering.
And we're not sure the astronauts who were there, the one who took the picture, even noticed it at the time, right?
Wayne Cernan and Harrison Schmitt, we do not know, A, whether they noticed it, although there was so much other junk in that crater that was sparkling, that was made of glass and metal and is not boulders and rocks. you just can't imagine they didn't see it. Although wearing those gold visors did limit their ability to see certain things.
Okay.
And one kind of wonders if, well, one kind of wonders.
Right.
But the key question in my mind, you know, after I found this thing and we found dozens of images, so there's no question that it was, you know, real and it was there and they took pictures of it. My big question is, did they, A, notice it, and, B, did they bring it home?
It home, yes.
Because just let your imagination wander. What if Apollo, per Kennedy's instruction, which we can get into later tonight, what the real reason for Apollo was in terms of what I now think it was, what if they brought this back and they were able somehow over the last 40 years, give or take, to figure out a way to talk to it? If you had a surviving robotic memory on the moon, and it was created by a technology not that much in advance of our technology, it is not inconceivable that after even millions of years, if you brought it back and put it in a lab and connected it to the right power, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
you could literally read out the memory or establish a two-way conversation depending upon the sophistication of the mm-hmm. robot in question. And obviously, if it was a functioning, autonomous robotic entity, it would be created in such a way that environmental extremes would have as minimal impact on its functioning as was possible with the technology of whatever year it was made.
And it could have been a camera head, so they may have been able to download pictures.
Well, remember, if it has eyes, it has incredible eyes that look like they are lenses. I mean, the thing
yes,
looks
they
like
look
C-3PO.
Like lenses.
It
yeah.
looks like C-3PO's head
Absolutely.
Lying on the moon.
Yes. As a matter of fact, one would think that George Lucas looked at that picture and decided to make C-3PO.
You know, I didn't want to really go there because that would take up a whole show in itself, but that scenario is actually not that far-fetched, George.
I know.
George Lucas is not the mild-mannered Hollywood producer that everybody thinks he is. And I have pretty interesting proof that he's a little more, and he's a little more plugged in than anybody might casually imagine.
Let's get your take on some of these missions back to the moon, unmanned. We'll be back. If you have not tried StreamLink yet, even when we've done our free StreamLink weekends and weeks, you can take advantage of it by
signing up for StreamLink by going to coasttocoastam.com. Pennies a day, and there you have it. StreamLink on Coast to Coast AM. We played a little Frank Sinatra for you, Richard, a while back, flying you to the moon.
I appreciate it.
What's going on with the moon these
days? Well, we're in a very interesting confluence of events right now. As you said, next week is the 40th anniversary, oh my gosh, of the Apollo 11 landing on the evening of July 20th, 1969. 40 years since that extraordinary event took place. Now, as you know, there has been a tremendous controversy, which has gotten kind of louder and louder over the years, from a certain noisy contingent claiming that this never even happened, that the whole thing's a hoax, that NASA made it up. Well, as those who have read Dark Mission, my New York Times bestseller with Mike Barra, know, and those who have not read it yet but will be reading it after tonight will find out, we document in Dark Mission that NASA itself is probably the originator of the "we never went to the moon" hoax.
Why?
That is an entire evening which we are going to have.
Don't drop these little monsters on me and not tell me.
The reason is very simple. If you look at the population of a country in terms of demographics, in terms of, coin a term here, a bell curve, then most of the population is in the middle of the curve, meaning most of the population believes what the government tells them. They believe what they see on CNN. They believe what they hear in church on Sunday morning.
Yep.
They believe what their rabbi tells them. They believe what their neighbors tell them. They believe what their family. In other words, most people believe. They don't ask questions because they don't have time to ask questions. They're too busy staying alive, making a living, and sending their kids to college and making car payments and house payments and credit card payments and all that. Well, many, many years ago when I was at JPL, I noticed something absolutely bizarre going on. This was back when I was for CBS covering the lunar missions. And I was there representing, you know, Walter and the whole CBS crew. And it was the afternoon, I think it was the afternoon before the astronauts, the Apollo 11 astronauts, who were coming back from the moon. And it's an incredible, extraordinary, unbelievable journey that we'd all watched on live television. They were about to splash down in the Pacific Ocean, about a day and a half from the time that I got to JPL, because we had moved our broadcast facilities from Downey, California, which is where North American Rockwell, which had built the major part of the Apollo spacecraft, had their factory. We had moved our transmitting facilities and our vans and remote crew and everything from there up to the mountains, up to the San Gabriel Mountains to Pasadena, because NASA also had scheduled, because of celestial mechanics, an unmanned set of flybys of Mars that same week, Mariner 6 and Mariner 7. So we moved our broadcast facilities up there to continue the coverage of the manned mission, the incredible, successful Apollo 11 coming home, and the yet-to-be-decided success of the unmanned Mars probes that were flying by later that same week.
Okay.
So I walk in, and there was the usual bedlam, you know, a million reporters trying to get press passes and press releases and desks and typewriters. And
a zoo.
Just close your eyes and you can imagine the bedlam. And I noticed this one guy prowling around the Von Karman Auditorium wearing, for one thing, it was a brilliant sunny summer afternoon, you know, July, I think it was 23rd, maybe 24th, something like that. And he's prowling around the chairs, the empty chairs in the auditorium, and he's taking something out of a little rucksack that he's carrying, and he's putting something on each chair. And that's not the most unusual thing. The most unusual thing was he was wearing what looked like one of those great coats, those long, floppy coats that cowboys used to wear in those 1800s films.
Yeah.
And it was completely out of place because it was hot. It was summer. It was summer in July in California. Even though we had air conditioning inside, it still was warm. So I'm watching this guy, and I kind of, you know, noticed that he then met on the far side of the auditorium with the head of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory Public Affairs Office, who then took him, his name was Frank Bristow, by the way, took him and escorted him to the press area outside the auditorium where all the high-end reporters had their desks and their faxes, or actually in those days we didn't have faxes, we had telex machines and phones and typewriters. Remember typewriters, George?
I've still got one. Don't use it, but I still have it.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to keep it.
I remember my first typewriter. Anyway, so I kind of followed them out at some distance to see what's going on, because I was really curious. What was this guy doing wearing this heavy, heavy trench coat? It was a light color. I think it was beige or cream or something. So it really stood out, but it was totally out of character for A, where he was, and B, the weather. So I'm watching as Frank is introducing this guy to all the major reporters for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, you know, NBC, ABC, Jules Bergman of ABC. Back in those days, I'm trying to think who was covering for NBC. It'll come to me.
Was it Richard Valeriani?
No, it may have been Hugh Downs in those days. Hugh was a really, you know, he still is. He's a great space guy. So they would have him cover all the space stuff in the early part of the coverage of the moon program. And, of course, Walter was not there yet because this was the afternoon. It wasn't the evening, and, you know, things were not going to happen for another day and a half. Or I think we had a special schedule for that night, but, the actual production crew had not shown up yet for that. So I'm watching as Frank Bristow, official representative of NASA, by way of JPL, head of public affairs, is introducing this guy around to, you know, Walter Sullivan of the New York Times and the L.A. Times science editor and the San Francisco Chronicle, Dave Perlman. You know, I mean, these are people that I lived with, literally, for years doing these various missions. And I couldn't stand apart, so I kind of edged my way into this group to see what was going on. And sure enough, the guy hands me the same thing he was handing to all the other reporters and putting on the chairs in the auditorium. And it was a little mimeoed pamphlet. I think it had two pages, and it was folded over. Remember mimeo machines? Mimeograph?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, even before Xerox. I mean, we're talking Stone Age stuff here. And inside was a Mylar, that was the high-tech part, a Mylar American flag, which was printed in weird colors. You know, the stripes were aluminum, because Mylar is basically aluminized plastic. And then the stripes were yellow. They weren't red. And the field of stars was I think, Mylar with holes cut in it so that you could hold up the light and see the stars through the background.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of mnemonic device. That was designed to hook you so that you, like, you know, monkeys reaching out for shiny things, you would pick this up and you'd hold it and you'd start looking at it. Well, we all did. And the pamphlet, this two-page mimeoed, I mean, it wasn't even Xeroxed, it was mimeo, basically described that NASA had just pulled off the biggest hoax in history because Apollo 11 had been shot on a soundstage in Nevada, and the astronauts were being, you know, wheeled by truck or bus or something to the celebration when they were brought back to the United States in Houston. And I remember looking at this in my hand and finding the nearest wastebasket and just tossing it because there was so much other stuff going on. There was crew coming in. There was lighting. There was, you know, telecom checks. I mean, if you're getting ready for a live broadcast with a network, you don't have a lot of time to just sit around and kind of read things. It wasn't until literally decades later, George, that, you know, when I got into what I've gotten into and realized that NASA lies, that as my intel friends have told me over the years, the lie is different at every level, which kind of became the mantra for Dark Mission.
And by the way, was it Jay Barbree, NBC?
Jay Barbree, NBC, yes.
Yep.
He was definitely one of the guys. What we would do, we had different people, you know, we had David Schoenbrunn at CBS. We had, I'm trying to remember the names, Bill Stout, who became a really good friend. He's no longer with us, but he was the
great
chief correspondent in the L.A. Bureau for CBS. When Walter was not there, you know, the second and the third tier would basically cover the moment to moment to moment parts of the mission. But yeah, it was Jay Barbary for NBC at that time, among many, including Hugh Downs. As I look back, I said to myself, I mean, this was years later when I realized that NASA does lie. I asked myself, kind of, wait a minute, what was this guy doing, handing out a pamphlet to all the world's press, because everybody who was anybody was there covering Apollo 11 for this incredible historic event that it was. And even more important, as I look back in hindsight, what was he doing being squired around by the head of JPL Public Affairs for NASA? And I now, of course, know, and I answered my own question in Dark Mission. It was to plant the meme, M-E-M-E, the memory device that would then hook into people's consciousness at the appropriate time and build a rising crescendo of people, the people who ask questions, the people who may be suspicious, the people who are suspect, the government doesn't talk to them straight, that doesn't tell them the truth, starting with NASA and spreading out. And the idea was to co-opt those people into, I'll hit it right on the head, a fake conspiracy that NASA never went to the moon, to supplant among those questioning people, which is a percentage on the right-hand side of that bell curve, of all the people that would never question anything government did, certainly in those days, so that the real conspiracy, which is what we found on the moon, what NASA and the astronauts discovered and brought back, would never see the light of day. That's the reason, George. It's to supplant one conspiracy for the real conspiracy. And I was there when it was born.
It's a shell game.
It's a shell game. And what I'm hoping is that by putting this in the book, that some of the reporters, because we had like 1,500 or 2,000 reporters, everybody from the New York Times to the Pasadena Shopping News, okay? I'm hoping that somebody within the sound of my voice saved that pamphlet and that little, you know, Mylar flag.
Yeah.
And has kept it in a file somewhere for history. You know, some history buff who said someday this could become important, or just this was what was going on at the time. And that by making enough noise about this, I can get someone to come forward who has saved this in a file, because, of course, mine disappeared in the wastebasket in the next few seconds.
Sure.
Because I thought it was nuts. I was 23, and I thought it was nuts then, and I think it's still nuts now. And now I know why it was nuts. But the fact is that he was being shepherded around and introduced by the head of NASA Public Affairs, and you don't have that happen unless it's a plot by NASA.
Maybe it's also why Wernher von Braun has said, be wary of a false flag that will have to do, let's say, with UFOs. Just be ready for something like that. Didn't he say that to his aide, Carol Rosen?
He said that to Carol, who I've known for years and years and years, long before this came to light. And I remember when Carol told me that the first time, and I had met von Braun through her, and I had actually spent some time with him and his daughter and Arthur Clark and Phil Chapman and a few other interesting people at JPL in 71 with the first orbiting of the first American Mars probe, Mariner 9, to go into orbit around Mars in November of that year. So, yeah, von Braun, as we now know in hindsight, knew a lot more than he let on. And in his waning days, as he was dying of cancer, he tried to warn everyone of some kind of plan, some kind of plot, some kind of, I'll hit it on the head again, conspiracy, to get the American people and the world to think one thing when, in fact, something else would be going on.
That's genius.
Well, it's also
it is genius.
Preserving your historical heritage if you care about your credibility. And it was almost with his last dying breath. And now, of course, we understand technologically what he meant and why he could have warned about that. Because as you know, and as will be appearing in the revised edition of Dark Mission, which I have just finished and sent off to the publisher 2 days ago, an extraordinary set of updates and revisions to the book which is going to make everybody who's got the original edition, I'm sorry, guys, you've got to go out and get the new one, because what you're going to read in the update is unbelievable. But unless you hold it in your hands and you read it and you look at the photographs, you're not going to remember. You're not going to believe what it is that you're going to see. We now have, in essence, a smoking gun to prove that NASA has been lying about many, many things for over 40 years.
Has that led you to make conclusions, for example, of the lunar dome model, for example?
Yes. What we have now had leaked to us in the last week or two by way of the current unmanned missions going back. I mean, the last NASA mission, manned mission, was in December of 72. It was Cernan.
That we know of.
Well, you always have to calibrate, you know, that we know of.
Sure.
In terms of the rocket technology, the Saturn V technology, the, you know, the clunky, you spit stuff out the back and a bush pushes you forward technology, which is what rockets are. I mean, there's no way you could launch large-scale rocket investigations of any place in the solar system with anybody on Earth already knowing about it because of, you know, global satellites and reconnaissance and the Internet and all that. But if you have anti-gravity, if you have a real space program, if you have put to a technology the physics that von Braun himself discovered the night he launched the first satellite, Explorer 1, in January of 1958, if you have that technology you've been quietly working on and developing and refining and perfecting and producing in large quantities, then in essence, yes, you can have a secret space program that would have none of the flash and flame and smoke and fury and thunder and attention-getting events around it that the so-called public program does. And, yeah, you could launch that from an island in the South Pacific. You could launch it from the Antarctic. You could launch it from the middle of Siberia. You could have whole bases in the middle of Australia where you come and go to the moon, to Mars, and to the outer solar system, and no one would ever know except for the defense satellites in orbit around the Earth of many countries, mainly us, the Soviet Union, ergo now Russia, and, of course, China. And what did we see happen recently, George, with regard to DOD space data and the civilian scientific community?
Well, as we know, they have said, we're not going to release our satellite information anymore.
And the question, of course, before the House is why this sudden change in policy after 15 years of pretty openly sharing
some
good stuff. I, by the way, sent you an update this afternoon on that story.
I have it.
Which, yeah, we can get to in a little while. It turns out it's a little more interesting than even we thought a couple, 3 weeks ago. But if you read that story, let me see. How do I want to do this? Do you want me to give you my impression, or do you want to give me your impression first?
Of why?
Of what they say in the news story, what Leonard David found out in terms of what they're now doing.
Well, I still think it's the original story, and
is.
That is
exactly
that they're hiding information.
And what they say in the update, what they told Leonard, was that they were going to look at the data and make sure that only non-security information was shared with the civilian community, which basically means they're going to have a screener.
Yes.
They're going to look at the good stuff, the stuff they don't want anybody to see, and they're going to pick and choose, cherry pick is the term, and give only that data to the scientists that will fit the natural bolide impacting objects from space model, which is what these scientists were upset that they weren't going to get anymore anyway. The good stuff, the stuff that I think they now want to keep secret, which is, you know, flying saucers, homegrown flying saucers made by human beings on this planet, zipping around in near-Earth space, that's the kind of data we're never supposed to get to see, ergo, from the confirmations of the secret space program.
Maybe Ed Grimsley is right with what he sees with his night vision goggles. We'll talk with Richard C. Hoagland more about this in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.